On this week's 51%, we hear from a former NASA engineer about science fiction heroines.
You know, what's going to happen is the women readership is going to start to demand, you know, more storylines and plots, et cetera, focused around women. And in general, I think that women demand a better story.
Then we meet a game maven, and the Army is opening its first autism therapy center. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. There are just a handful of female science fiction heroes in popular culture. There's Ripley from the Alien franchise, Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica, Ellie Arroway from Carl Sagan's Contact. They're all memorably strong female characters from movies, television, and books. Historically, the genre has undeniably been dominated by men since it gained popularity in the early to mid-20th century. But that's changing these days. More and more women are stepping up on the pages and the screens in a genre that is exploding with popularity. Former NASA space shuttle engineer and sci-fi author Darren Beyer has written about the disparity of leading ladies in the science fiction genre. His newest novel, Casimir Bridge, follows the journey of a female science journalist, Mandisa Nkosi, as she works to uncover a conspiracy within an intergalactic economy brimming with futuristic technology. 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall spoke with Beyer recently about why he chose a female protagonist.
Darren Beyer, welcome to 51%.
Glad to be here.
So you are a space shuttle engineer. We'll start out with that. What exactly did that entail?
So I was what's called a space shuttle experiment engineer, and I firmly believe that it was the best job I could possibly get at NASA, and I got it right out of school, so I really lucked out. What we did was our group were able to put any scientific experiments that may fly on the shuttle, we would put together, we would test them, we'd end up putting them on the shuttle, and we'd train astronauts on them. Some of them were time critical, so we'd be up on the launch pad, you know, literally just a few hours before launch, and we would be on the ground on landing. We were the second vehicle in the convoy, and we'd go in right afterwards and take them back out again to get the science to the experimenters. So it was a lot of fun, got to crawl around spaceships and do some pretty interesting things.
That kind of makes you uniquely qualified to be an author of science fiction.
Yeah, you know what was interesting was when I was looking for editors, I went through two editors, and the first one was a science fiction editor, and I didn't get great results. And then when I came back, I said, you know, I don't need to have a science fiction editor. I need to have an editor. I think I know as much science out of the science fiction part as anybody who's writing in the genre. So what happens is a lot of the things that people may have to research otherwise come naturally to me. I can, you know, build things into the story that other people may not think about. And that's really what I've done with my first book, Casimir Bridge, is that, I've spent a lot of time making sure that the technology and the science are correct.
Your protagonist in Casimir Bridge is a female, and you have done research, extensive research, on why it is that perhaps there aren't that many female protagonists in the sci-fi genre.
When you look at the science fiction genre, it has traditionally been a male-dominated genre. You go back to the late 40s, the predecessor to Analog Magazine in 1948 had a 6% female readership. You know, so very low. And I think that parallels, you know, sort of women in technology, right? You didn't have a lot of women that were in the more scientific and technical fields back in the late 40s. But then, you know, that number started to grow, and along with it, science fiction readership started to grow. So in the early 70s, in 1974, female readership of that magazine was up to about 25%. And so it's growing. And now, you know, you fast forward another 40 years, and, you know, I think that women and men are, you know, roughly on parity in technical and scientific jobs. And when you look at the numbers of women reading science fiction, while an individual man is more likely to have read science fiction than an individual woman has been, because women read more fiction than men do, the actual numbers pretty much even out. So if it was a political poll, you'd be in a statistical dead heat between the two.
Are there as many female writers of science fiction as there are males? Is that on parity?
There doesn't seem to be, and it's not that there haven't been. You know, there's been some great ones. Even going back, you know, to the 60s and 70s, when science fiction really started to take off, you had, you know, writers like Ursula K. Le Guin, who's known for, you know, really more for her Earthsea fantasy series than science fiction, but she wrote a lot of science fiction. And there's a number of others that wrote during that time. That, there are a couple that even put on male pseudonyms just because they wanted to appeal more to the genre. And so I think there have been a number of writers, but they've been really far outnumbered by male writers. And I think that, again, is starting to change. I've read a couple books recently that have had either women writers or co-writers as a part of it. And again, it's starting to kind of pick up a little bit more just because the demographics of the readership of the genre are changing.
Now, what's it like? I know this can be generalized to different genres of writing, but what is it like trying to personify a female character from a male perspective, from your perspective as a male?
Well, so there's two aspects to it, right? And I'm going to give you some, a deep, dark look into my psyche when I tell you part of this.
But, please, bring it on.
On the one hand, I've been fortunate to have had a number of very strong women in my life. Between my wife, my mother is top in her field in what she does in the world. My grandmother was 5'0" and commanded a room. And so I've just been around very strong women my entire life. So writing a strong female character is not difficult from from viewing them and what their actions are. And my writing tends to be a little bit more in that third person, even though I am going into the point of view of the main character. Where I run into problems is around some of the intimacy stuff. And, a lot of men have issues with intimacy. I certainly do. And as a result of that, I have a very difficult time getting into sort of what would be happening in the more personal of the interpersonal moments. And fortunately, I had a woman editor, and she helped me through a lot of that and helped me get over some of my hang-ups. But that's probably the most difficult part of the entire thing.
Where do you see the sci-fi genre going in the future? Do you see there being more female characters and more female writers going forward?
I really do. I think this is going to start to pick up. And the reason is that, when you're roughly on parity between male and female readers, and you also are getting more mainstream science fiction in movies, and so that's drawing in additional viewers and then readers of the genre. What's going to happen is the women readership is going to start to demand, more storylines and plots, et cetera, focused around women. And in general, I think that women demand a better story. I think the genre is going there, so The Martian is a great example. I give this other example quite a bit as well, as a book called The Atlantis Gene, and there's two follow-on books in the series by an author by the name of A.G. Riddle that are both what I like to call smart science fiction, where they really get the story right, they get the technology right, and they don't rely on the genre as a crutch. And I think that has traditionally been an issue, and it's one of the reasons why women have been turned off, I believe, to the genre in the past. Is, you take away the greats like Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and those kind of guys. A lot of the science fiction work was, again, relying on the genre. And I think that's starting to change, and with it are coming sort of more sophisticated readers.
Who are your favorite female sci-fi characters in anything that you've read or watched?
Oh, I mean, that's an easy one. You got to give me a harder question than that. I think it's got to be, Ripley in the Alien series.
Ah, that was why money was on Ripley, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great one. There's another one is in the Terminator series.
Sarah Connor.
There's pretty strong woman character that's pretty badass in what she does. But I think Ripley, because the character is so strong, it overcomes a lot of, sort of the stereotypes that are there, and it's also, the first two movies were just excellent. The second one being my favorite. I don't know that Cameron puts out a bad science fiction movie ever. So, and that Ripley character was probably the strongest character in the movie. It was certainly the main character in the movie, and likely was the strongest as well.
Do you think there's a difference between the presence of female characters between movies and TV and fiction literature?
I believe that because TV and movies tend to be more mainstream, you have to have a broader presence in those media. And, books, it hasn't been as much, I should say, there. And so therefore, as a result, there's still, the genre's still playing catch up in that regard. And I will say that, the vast majority of science fiction books have women characters in them. They just don't tend to be in the primary role.
Now, do you think that there are issues with sort of over-sexualization of women in the sci-fi genre thus far? Have you run into that? Or do you see that as something that's, rather than a woman being a main character in a primary role as a scientist, there it kind of gets overshadowed maybe by the sexualization of women. Do you see that at all?
You know, I see that more in the, I think, in the fantasy realm than I do in the science fiction realm. I think it is there. You know, again, when you look at the traditional audience of the genre, you get some, just because of that, you will get some of that. But I haven't run into it as much lately. And the books that I've been reading, the science fiction books I've been reading lately, you know, the stereotypes have tended to be taken down. They're diminished. And the strength of the characters has tended to be, tended to go up. So I think more modern writers are kind of catching on and staying away from that. It's becoming a taboo in a lot of areas of society to portray women in that regard. And so I think authors are picking up on that. But you know, I will say there's a negative area where that still is present. You'll see it at sometimes at science fiction conventions. There's definitely an objectification of women that goes on at those at the conventions. You know, women are tending to go around, and when people are in costume or what have you, they tend to be, in skimpy, revealing costumes, and the guys tend to like it, right? So there's that aspect. And then there's, it's also in the computer gaming industry, which is, sort of a parallel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been to a couple of conventions, and I probably lost count of the number of slave Leias I saw walking around,
Right.
On booth babes and all that stuff. You chose a female protagonist because you didn't see a lot of them in the genre.
Well, I wish I could say that I was that far-sighted when I started writing this, and the answer is I wasn't. The answer is that I wrote the female protagonist. There were the two protagonists. There was a female protagonist and a male protagonist, and one of them was primary. Initially, it was the male character who was the primary protagonist, and he is the CEO of the sort of that protagonist or the good company. And Mandy, who's the female protagonist, was the secondary one. Now I wrote her as a very strong character. Again, I've got very strong female influences in my life, and so it just is kind of natural for me to write a strong woman character. And as I was writing it and going through some rewrites, I realized that her story was far more compelling and her character was far more believable than the other one. So I shifted the two around and made her the primary. And so she dominates really the story.
Interesting. It's always interesting to hear the journeys that writers make with their characters and their storylines and such. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That was former NASA space shuttle engineer and science fiction author Darren Beyer speaking with 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Janice Hill is a gamer, not video games, but tabletop role-playing games. Just think Dungeons & Dragons. Since 1981, she's been a game master, the godlike leader of one particular game, Call of Cthulhu. For many years, Hill was the only woman at the table, but she's been able to create a game that's unlike any other. Lacey Roberts has the story.
It's April 1933, and the team is at the stone-walled World Library in Tibet, doing what they can to prepare for a looming alien invasion. After a long day of magical research, they get ready for dinner.
Yak cheese, yak burgers, yak milk.
Yak what?
All parts of yak.
Dr. Montgomery Scott wants to go to Cairo to meet the shipments of humanitarian aid. Heinrich Müller wants to visit the alchemists in Russia. And, as ever, it's difficult to keep Darling focused on the coming fight. She's a Hollywood actress. She has other concerns.
Well, California's nice. They have nice beaches. I mean, why wouldn't you want to go to California? As a widow, I think my opportunities are even more increased now that I'm unfortunately grieving for my poor dead husband.
Don't you need a longer grieving period before?
Well, this is the 30s, I am a modern woman.
Okay, so clearly they're not actually in a library in Tibet. Darling isn't a Hollywood actress. They're playing a game.
Currently, my character is named Darling Doctor.
My character is Heinrich Müller.
Nibi is my character that I play.
Is a Bavarian, not a German.
A diviner.
Richard Chamberlain is a writer.
The game's called Call of Cthulhu, based on the fictional universe created by horror writer H.P. Lovecraft. In this tabletop role-playing game, the game master guides a group of players through an interactive adventure. There's no board, The game is played through conversation. It's kind of like improv theater, but around a table and without an audience. The most famous of these games is Dungeons and Dragons, stereotypically played by pimply-faced teenage boys in a basement. But today, 5.5 million Americans play tabletop role-playing games, and it's not just the boys.
I first started getting involved with the gaming hobby back in 1975, which was kind of before there were any women at all.
Janice Hill is the game master, though she prefers the term game maven.
It was all about killing monsters and getting loot and saving the princesses. And at that time, there were a lot of women who were trying to break those molds, focusing on story and character development.
In 1981, she convened 5 players for her first session of Call of Cthulhu. Janice had no idea that first session would kick off a game that's still being played 35 years later.
I can't think of anything else in the world that I would rather be doing.
As the leader of her own game, Janice has felt free to push the envelope, testing the edge of what's typically covered in the tabletop role-playing world.
I'm a lot more willing to tackle things like gender issues and same-sex relationships. And just that maturing process has given the things that I write a lot more depth, a lot more color, which I think makes for more interesting play.
Thomas Albin, who plays Richard Chamberlain, thinks Janice's game is unique.
I have never been involved in a game like this before. Obviously, she starts with the Call of Cthulhu mechanics, but the game that she has created around it is so much richer. It is amazing.
These days, Janice is in her 50s, and aside from her family, her games take up most of her time. She runs 4 different groups of 6 to 8 characters, all working on the same campaign to stop the alien incursion they expect to hit Egypt this month. A storyline that has its roots in the first game she played back in 81.
You get really attached to these people, not in a kind of a creepy, obsessive way, but you follow their struggles. It's like reading about your favorite characters in a book. You don't want the book to end.
I'm Lacey Jane Roberts.
The Army is planning to open its first autism therapy center. It will serve about 150 children of military personnel in Tacoma, Washington, and it comes after years of complaints from military families that they have a hard time finding autism therapy while they're serving in the armed forces. Patricia Murphy reports.
While stationed in Germany, Army nurse practitioner Major Ruth Racine and her husband carved out a promising educational and therapeutic plan for their 7-year-old son Magnus, who has autism. During and after school, he got occupational, physical, and speech therapy.
We were in an absolutely fantastic place for my son through the Department of Defense school system. He was in a developmental program, and he had speech therapy that he was getting inside the classroom. And then we had also lined up speech therapy in the community, as well as occupational therapy, and he was starting physical therapy.
But about a year and a half ago, Racine was transferred to Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Tacoma, Washington. Magnus still has some therapy in his new school, but getting the outside help he needs is a problem. Those services aren't available on base, and local therapists in the community are in high demand.
When you call the place to say, okay, great, I have my referral letter, I have my son who needs this, they'll say, okay, great, but right now we don't have room for you. We'll put you on a wait list, and you are on a wait list for 5 different places.
More than a year later, she's still waiting, and so are a lot of other U.S. military families with autistic children at bases around the world. There are 23,000 military dependents with an autism diagnosis, more than 1,000 around Joint Base Lewis-McChord.
That's definitely an issue that we do run into as a whole, I think, as a military community.
Gretchen Shea is a regional administrator for the online group American Military Families Autism Support. Her husband is in the Navy, stationed at Whidbey Island, Washington. They have 2 children with autism.
There's options there, but the wait lists are there because everybody needs either after school or there's only, you know, 1 or 2 speech therapists for a huge area.
The situation is so bad that when Penn State University conducted a survey of military spouses, about 80% say they've had difficulty obtaining services for their children. Now, next to this preschool at Washington's Joint Base Lewis-McChord, the Army plans to take a small step to address the problem. Inside this repurposed child development center will be the Army's first standalone therapy and education facility for children with autism and their families. Lieutenant Colonel Eric Flake is a doctor and the director of Madigan Army Medical Center's Developmental and Behavioral Pediatric Program.
There's going to be programs to teach parents as they have a new diagnosis. A large focus will be in some group after school type of therapy opportunities. Additionally, during the workday, this will also be a therapy center where kids will get direct speech therapy, will get direct occupational therapy.
He hopes by early next year, the center will take some of the pressure off families and help a lot of kids.
We anticipate great outcomes, ones that will be measured, ones that will be identified, and we'll be able to report those back and demonstrate that impact.
Major Ruth Racine says it'll make a big difference for her family.
My husband sent me the link for the Facebook page about the program, and tears came to my eyes immediately, because as a parent, this represents hope.
But Gretchen Shea from the Military Families Group has mixed feelings about the project. The center will only serve 150 children at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. While she's happy those families will benefit some, she says the Department of Defense needs to do a lot more to serve autistic children everywhere.
That's a great start. I do feel that it's kind of just a drop in the bucket.
Neither the Army Surgeon General's Office nor the Defense Health Agency would speculate about the future of the program. They haven't said whether they might build similar programs at other bases to serve the thousands of other autistic military children whose parents are struggling to find timely care. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
For orphan children, sometimes there's no cake or goodies to share on their birthdays. 21-year-old Tabile Tabete in South Africa is trying to change this by baking cakes for orphans around Johannesburg to celebrate their birthdays. One day each month, she visits the care centers to celebrate all the children who had a birthday that month. DW correspondent Loveday Wright presents this report by Stefan Mueller.
Today is Tulizeli Ramphora's 16th birthday. She lives in the Christchurch Christian Care Center, an orphanage in central Johannesburg. Tulizeli has been looking forward to this day when the care center organizes a party for all birthday boys and girls of the month who live at the orphanage. Everyone gets a piece of cake baked by 21-year-old Tabile Tabete. Her enterprise, Tea Party, also produces patisserie for paying clients. Tabile uses part of her profits for her birthday cake project.
I always liked to volunteer at orphanages. Even when I was younger, I used to volunteer at orphanages. So what actually happened was I was looking for ways to volunteer, and I Googled how to, like, different ways to volunteer, and I came across baking birthday cakes for orphans.
Baking does not only make Tabile happy. The children and the young adults also enjoy celebrating their birthdays. Bonani Mdlovu is one of the birthday boys. He's just turned 19.
It's a nice feeling. You feel welcome. Yeah, you feel appreciated and celebrated.
Birthdays are often difficult days for orphan children. Tulizeli lost her parents 8 years ago. When her grandmother gave her into the custody of the care centre, Tulizeli found a new home and family. The centre took care of her education, and now she would like to study architecture.
For them, education comes first. At home, we had financial problems. They couldn't take me to school anymore. And yeah, that was a problem. And I was living with my grandmother. Yeah, and she couldn't take care of me.
Tabile learned how to bake from her grandmother, who inspired her. Now she wants to do the same for the children at the orphanage.
So we're going to start baking cupcakes today. Okay.
Recently, yeah, she started to offer baking classes where she teaches young children how to bake great cakes.
With the baking lessons, we try to just make the kids have fun, but at the same time, we also want them to learn. So not only are they learning baking, but they can also learn math at the same time. So this is kind of my way of combining the two things I love. I love children and I love baking, so that's why I thought the baking would be a good idea.
That was Deutsche Welle correspondent Loveday Wright presenting a report by DW Stefan Mueller. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1407.